You're listening to a 3CR podcast of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia.
Radio MMT respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land from which we are broadcasting, the Wurundjeri people, and we are broadcasting to the Kulin nations. Our focus is economics, that is, how stuff is produced and distributed. We recognise that for many tens of thousands of years, First Nations people's connection to country successfully embodied the world's oldest continuous economy, which was catastrophically disrupted by genocide and displacement. We acknowledge that we have much to learn to reshape our current extractive and exploitive system to achieve sustainable prosperity for everyone.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev.
Radio MMT.
Looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory.
Radio MMT.
Macroeconomics for a well-being economy.
Macroeconomics? Like, isn't that incredibly boring?
No, Kevin, it's incredibly interesting. It's all about who gets what and why.
Who gets what and why? Okay, I'm in.
Radio MMT at gmail.com.
Incredibly interesting macroeconomics for the rest of us.
Hello, dear listener, and welcome to Radio MMT. I'm your host, Anne, and today Kev is roaming around the countryside in his van, but he will be back again. So while Kev is away, I thought I would have a chat with retired civil engineer and friend of the show, Ray Maxwell. Now, Ray, aka my father, he's taken a good look at modern monetary theory, and he emerged with a 1A4 15-point page answer to what is modern monetary theory. And he also emerged with some fighting words, and those were: austerity is murder, a job guarantee is essential to a civilized society, and applying the insights of MMT to address global warming is the only future we have. Now, these fighting words, they do go beyond the technical core of MMT, but they do tell us why bother? Why bother learning this kind of macroeconomics? But in this conversation, we do go back to the basics of MMT for anyone who's trying to grapple with this stuff. So I do hope that you enjoy our conversation. Well, today I am speaking with a close relative of mine who is actually my father, who for the purposes of this interview I will call Ray. Ray, welcome to Radio MMT.
Hello, Anne.
Now, you and I, Ray, we have had many chats about MMT over the years as a result of my involvement with Radio MMT and other things. And of course, the MMT there stands for Modern Monetary Theory, which is a school of macroeconomics.
Yeah.
And I guess what prompted me to want to record a conversation with you is because you presented me with a one-page summary of modern monetary theory. I gather that this was a pretty hard-won effort that has been literally years in the making for you.
Yep.
And I was wondering when you first came across MMT and when I first mentioned some of these crazy MMT ideas to you, were you a skeptic then or were you already a little bit open to it?
I wasn't open to it, and I'm skeptical about a lot of things, including MMT, and just a couple of the things you said made me go and do a bit of reading. And probably the thing that shocked me first was that taxes don't fund anything. And I thought, that doesn't make sense.
That's one of the big ones, isn't it? People often get quite shocked to hear MMTers say that taxes don't fund spending.
Yeah.
And of course, there's a bit of a nuance in that because we're talking about federal taxes, not state and local taxes.
Well, I ended up producing this, I see it's 15-point list, because they don't all come out in order when you start talking to people and reading.
Mm.
And every now and again, something pops out. The idea that spending by government comes before taxation. And that was a hard one for me to get across. But I'll tell you what switched me on with that one was the history of when the British were fighting the French in America.
Oh, okay.
The Virginia and Massachusetts militias that tried to pinch the gold from the treasury the French controlled in Quebec.
Oh, did they? I don't know those details.
Well, the soldiers came back from that. They lost. They couldn't get to the treasury. It was a torturous undertaking.
The colonial soldiers?
Well, they were just farmers, really, or squatters, I suppose. Those that came back had nothing, and it must have been the Bank of England, which was then operational. This is back in late 1600s. And what the government decided to do was give these returning soldiers a piece of paper that paid for their taxes so that when they're exposed to taxes, they can hand over a piece of paper that the government had given them. And that's recorded as the first Western paper money, because these bits of paper became tradable in effect.
Mm.
The other thing about it was that when those bits of paper finally got back to the government, they were burnt. So
there you go. That's some actual history that the government spends the money before it receives the money in taxes.
Exactly right. And that started me taking it a little bit more seriously.
Well, before we go into those 15 points of yours that do fit onto one A4 page, although I must admit you use a pretty small font and very narrow margins.
Oh, no.
Before we get to that list, in the run-up to this conversation, you did mention to me that MMT has revealed some major things to you. And I thought we might look at the three major things that you were mentioning, mostly because I see these sorts of things as the why bother part, like why even bother with this macroeconomics that's called MMT? And so the first one you mentioned was austerity is murder. And what's more, you're even saying that it's murder committed by our governments. And that's pretty strong language, Ray. How do you justify that?
Well, it's one of the three things when you get your head across how MMT works. I'm not particularly interested in all the details of financialization and macroeconomics and that. But the consequences that come out of it is an understanding that austerity is murder, because what we have had over the last 30 to 40, 50 years is an increasing development of macroeconomics related to what's called neoliberalism. And the basic policy there is to maintain a level of unemployment and what I call social disadvantage to the point where it makes it much easier for capital, the big money people, to manage their labour forces, because from their point of view, people are best kept in a position of fear of losing their job. And to do that, you need a reasonable size, as big as possible actually, of unemployed, and it's not just unemployed, but underemployed, and that is because they don't have a job that's paying them enough, or they're not getting enough hours. And they're all statistical records of the Bureau of Statistics. Those numbers are all there. They are the people that are really suffering. And this exists as deliberate policy, and both the Labor Party and the Liberal Party are the supporters and implementers of neoliberal policies. It's just a matter of government policy that we maintain that level of disadvantage so that big money can make its profits much easier than it would otherwise.
And I guess we should define what we mean by austerity. My understanding is that it means the government is spending less and not mobilising resources when it otherwise could be.
Well, that's right. MMT got onto the idea of a job guarantee.
Oh, that was your second claim. A job guarantee is essential to a civilised society.
Well, that's right. And a job guarantee addresses the issue of austerity. The job guarantee should be a proper livable wage at a level where you can afford to both maintain a family and a home. Anyone who is born into a society or is invited into a society should have a right to a job.
So why are you saying that it's murder? Like, you talked about disadvantage. Like, is murder just an exaggeration or a hyperbole?
Well, it's death. it's death. People who are placed in a position of significant social disadvantage, they don't have a job, they are denigrated by society, perhaps as one of the favourites of the 70s is the dole bludger, and victimised, as they did through the Morrison government, victimised the unemployed. That leads to suicide.
Mm.
And you know, I've had personal observation of that, and it only exists because those people didn't have opportunity early in their lives.
Well, you're not the first to say austerity is murder, of course. It's something I often hear Stephen Grumbine say on the podcast Macro and Cheese, which is a podcast I highly recommend people also have a listen to. And you will often hear him say austerity is murder. And yes, there are direct links from government policy through to the despair and suffering of people.
Exactly. And while I can well understand, because I've lived through the inflationary period of the late 60s, 70s, and I know the pain and agony that business saw with the spiralling inflation that occurred. But it still comes back to a need for good management of labour. And if you're not a good manager, then get out of the business you're in and let somebody else do it.
Mm.
The whole of society should be saying to business, this is what one of your jobs is. And I call the management that can't do it the real bludgers on society.
Mm.
Like it should be a responsibility of government to provide the education required.
That's an interesting twist, is to flip the job guarantee around and say, well, what's going on when you don't have a job guarantee? You've often said to me, oh, it enables managers to get away with not creating workplaces that people want to be a part of.
That's exactly right. You know, they might have rotten jobs, but if what they're doing is appreciated by management for doing it, then that increases the motivation to come to work.
Have you actually seen that since the 70s, that CEOs and managers have changed their attitude towards how they manage?
Well, I guess so, in that I was responsible for employing people on a number of occasions. You'd get 10, 20 or 30 applications when we have this higher levels of unemployment. And it makes management so much easier. We pick through the people who've got all the skills we want and going to be successful at the job, rather than taking on people that look like they could handle the job but need a better training.
Mm.
You compare that from when my wife and I came from our travel overseas.
Would be my mother.
Oh, yes. And we came back to Australia. I know we had 2 and 6 pence in our pockets.
Oh, wow. Came back with that much.
And the last bit of money we had before that was to give a tip to the fellow who looked after us on the boat. And we travelled by ship in those days. But anyway, all I did was sit down and write away 3 letters to 3 different companies. And I had an answer back within a few days. And I picked one and I started work the next Monday.
Wow. That's the late 60s, isn't it?
That was the late 60s, yeah. Well, so anyway, when I got through all of the MMT stuff and sort of got my 15 points written down,
yep.
The job guarantee, to me, that's the critical thing.
The third point that you did mention to me ahead of this interview was that MMT also reveals how we can deal with the current polycrisis, otherwise known as global warming and shooting through planetary boundaries. And in fact, you said that understanding and applying the government's capacity, according to MMT, it's the only future path we have. Again, another big claim.
Well, that's right, because we can't run an economy that's exploiting 80% of the population and leaving 20% disadvantaged and all the externality costs that are associated with that. Neoliberalism is about destroying government.
Mm.
And like you can see it in America now.
Where, it's coming to the end game.
And that started with Reagan saying government's not the solution but the problem. And that's true enough. If you're a capitalist wanting to extract as much wealth as you can, they're right. And so if we're going to address the what I call global eating, because I think that's where we're headed. Mm. We need the planning and control of government to allocate the resources required.
So it's not the money that we have to worry about.
It's not money, it's allocation of resources, and that's what MMT is very clear about, whether it's allocated by private enterprise or government. And what government should be doing is ensuring that all of our resources are applied to the needs of society, and the biggest one facing us is global warming.
You're listening to 3CR 855 AM on digital and on the internet. www.3cr.org.au.
MMT has had very little in the way of mainstream support, even though it was formulated over 25 years ago now.
And got underway in the 90s with two or three people, Bill Mitchell and Warren Mosler, I find out.
So I find in talking to people, it's not unusual for newbies to say, well, where's the definitive guide that I can read? And often they can't find it, and they end up doing what you did, which is make a little summary sheet for themselves. And what is out there that is very useful, I'll put a list of those in the show notes. But in the meantime, Ray, in the spirit of helping someone else avoid the hard work of having to pull all the basics together and going round in circles in what you call the fog of confusion, shall we go through some of your points?
Right.
The first one that you have here is that modern monetary theory is kind of modern in a strange way.
Well, it is. I came to see the idea of modern being the end of a long train of human evolution in economics going back 5,000 years to Mesopotamia.
Mm. The modern started out as an insider joke when they named this school of economic thought, because it referred to, I think, a quote from John Maynard Keynes, which said that money is a modern invention. It's only 5,000 years old.
Yeah. Well, that's right. Well, it is modern in the sense of bracketed in 5,000 years.
Okay. So the next main concept that we need to get our heads around is national sovereignty. That's your next point.
Well, this was part of my fog. MMT people refer to government all the time. Mm. And they do identify where they need to, a sovereign government. But the basic is a state government is not like a federal government.
Mm.
And it's the sovereign government that creates the currency. State governments can't do it. You and I can't do it unless we're engaged in counterfeiting money. So state governments are different to federal government in that state governments have to do what you and I have to do. They have to have an income to be able to spend, and or have to have the capacity to borrow money.
Mm.
Federal government, it's a different economic entity altogether. No one appreciate. I don't think, I didn't appreciate the difference. It's, something just clicked. I thought, oh, that's right. I get it now. State governments are just like you and I. They have to raise taxes. That's their income. And they do that all sorts of ways, like finding me for doing 45 kilometres an hour across Story Bridge.
Did that happen?
That's cost me $300.
Whoa!
$322, I'll have to tell you.
I could tell that one hurt.
Yeah. But I just put it down, oh, well, that's state government income.
Mm.
And they've got little speed cameras all over the place creating income.
Income generating speed cameras.
Oh, that's what they do. And good luck to them. But they're, you know, there's lots of other sources like royalties on minerals. Mm. So they are budget constrained.
Mm.
They have to run a budget that's constrained by the amount of money that they raise, which includes taxes, whereas a federal government is not budget constrained.
Mm.
They are only restrained by the available resources in the nation. And one way to look at the available resources, it's look at what's our unemployment level and social disadvantage. That is all unused resources.
Yes. I used to get offended when economists talked about unemployed people as resources. People are different from other kinds of resources, like a rock in the ground or whatever. But I don't now, because I realize it's just one way of reclaiming the lives of these people and saying, well, yes, it's a way of identifying where the government isn't doing its job.
Well, there's a moral obligation attached to it, which is that resource has a right to a job.
Whereas a rock doesn't have a right to be mined.
Rock doesn't, no. Exactly.
Well, we've covered another point, because your point six here was the difference between a currency user and a currency issuer. And I guess that parallels this idea of the difference between the state and federal government, which you've just mentioned.
Well, that's where I did buy and read Stephanie Kelton's book, The Deficit Myth, and she separates the concept of a currency issuer, which is a sovereign government, and they create the money by taking an instruction from Parliament and filling out a ledger in the Treasury or the Central Bank. And everyone else, including the state governments, businesses, NGOs, you and I, are all currency users.
In Australia, it's only the federal government that creates the Australian dollars. However, in the monetary system, we have two places that money comes from. And as Kevin and I were talking about this the other day and saying, it took us a while to get our heads around this.
Well, it did me, and took a lot of thought to sort of get it together in my head, particularly the bank one. So there are two forms of money. One is the fiat currency that the federal government creates by filling out ledgers. So it spends money into the economy by instruction, and then what's called bank credit. And this one had me tossed for a while, because what I had no idea of, that banks don't lend out depositors' money.
Yeah, that's one of the huge shocks. I had no idea. I thought when I put my money into the bank that somebody else was borrowing it.
Well, we're all trained to that, and I grew up in the days when the Commonwealth Bank used to give every primary school child a bank book. And you'd take it home, and your mother, most my mother did, give me 20 cents, it wasn't 20 cents, 2 shillings a week, pocket money, and I'd take it to school, and it'd be banked in that pocketbook.
Mm.
And I, through my life, assumed that that's what the banks were managing and were using to issue mortgages.
Mm. Your 2 shillings went into someone's house.
Yes, a whole 2,000 of us probably in those days. bank credit, but it was something I think I heard Bill Mitchell say, that a bank is not lending out deposits. It only lends money when somebody comes through the door that the bank assesses can repay a loan. And the more shocking thing out of that is the bank creates money. If I go in there and I want to borrow, you know, for a house in Sydney, I want to borrow $1 million, and then the bank assesses that I can pay that back, they write $1 million in their asset ledger, and they write in my Commonwealth Bank primary school bank account $1 million. And they've created $1 million of bank credit, which is, it's their liability to me and it's my liability to them.
Mm.
And it's $1 million just by writing numbers on ledgers. So they're the two forms of money, bank credit money and federal government fiat money.
Mm.
And that is all the money in the economy.
And there's a big difference between the two, which Kev was trying to explain the other day, being that the credit money that the bank creates always has to disappear again. In other words, once the loan is repaid, that money disappears out of the economy. But with the money that the federal government creates, that can just stay in the economy. The way it disappears, as we'll get to in a moment, is through taxation. Just go back to a higher level concept here. You had in point four what a good way of looking at the macro economy is.
Yeah, that was important to me, and that's why I've got it up there at four, because I think that's where it should come if you're trying to go toward an understanding of MMT. Everyone thinks the economy is one thing, because that's how it appears in the news all the time, and commentators, they're always on about the economy. But you can see the economy is three basic levels. The basic one is what's called the real economy, and that's the work that everybody does out in private commerce and activities of government dealing with producing of goods and services and consumption of resources. Whether it's making teddy bears for Christmas or building an excavator to make a road. And that's all real economy stuff. And then sitting over the top of that is what's called the financial economy.
Mm.
The financial economy is where you get the existence of shares and markets and derivatives of markets, all the trading that goes on.
Mm.
And then over the top of that is the government strategy, which is called macroeconomics. And MMT is talking about macroeconomics and all the things that have to be done around government structures like central banks. Now, it just helped me clarify where MMT fits in and what it's explaining.
And you do hear in the commentary, you do hear people talk about the real economy, but I never understood that they meant a specific thing. I just thought they meant the actual economy or something, you know. So it took me a while to realise what they mean by this word real, which is basically, like you said, the goods and services, the real stuff that's going on. And then the financial economy, I think, is necessary because we have a monetary system. But I also get a sense that some of the people, especially the progressive economists who are critiquing the system, they would see a lot of the financial economy as unnecessarily and possibly dangerous bloat. In other words, it's highly parasitic on the real economy and it needs to be, you know, we need to get out the pesticides and and hose that parasite down and get it back under control again so we don't see another 2008 global financial crisis.
I agree 100%, and there are certain areas, and one of them I came to realise is the issue of bonds.
Ah, hang on, that's number 13.
Yeah, I'm skipping down the list a bit. Well, you're right that in the financialisation area there is a lot of, as you call it, bloat. You know, you could call it a job guarantee type of employment where people are running around in circles doing nominal jobs. There's a book called Bullshit Jobs.
Oh, yes, by Dave Graeber.
And I could well imagine...
bond market... operators would be in the BS job category.
Yeah.
You're with Anne and Kev on Radio MMT.
At 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia.
And wherever you get your podcasts.
Economics for the rest of us.
We're talking about fiat money and the government's capacity to spend. And so now here you've got in your items at number 7, the unlimited capacity of the government to spend. So when you tell people that the government can spend as many dollars as it wants or needs to, they usually fall off their chair.
Exactly right. Apoplexy straight away.
Well, is it true? I mean, how can this be true?
That caused me to pause for a while, but given my background, I came to fairly easily, I think, understand that because there is the qualified limit there always from MMT that the capacity is limited by the available resources that the nation has.
So why do you say your background helped you understand that?
Well, I was involved in a couple of major engineering projects and I was involved in a lot of legal arguments on one particular project, hundreds of millions of dollars involved. And I was presented with the complexities of a critical path program that had hundreds of activities on it. And there were all these faults occurring in this activity, that activity, and all over the place. But one day I realised that all our arguments were capable of being understood by looking at the resource input.
Mm.
And so, to my mind, MMT people get all tied up in talking about money, but it's really about resources. And money is a unit of account to allocate resources to the economy. And so what I say is that what we should have is a Department of Resources sitting over the top of the Treasury.
I'd like to see the Department of Biocapacity personally, which is another way of saying Department of Resources. And within that, there would be the Department of Allocating Resources.
Exactly. To the right sort of works to be done.
Right.
But yes, there is an unlimited capacity to spend, but obviously you can only allocate your expenditure if you've got the resources.
So like if the government was saying it wants to offer universal childcare, it can only employ as many childcare workers as exist. So if we needed 50,000 childcare workers and there's only 25,000, spending the extra money.
Well, that's why you need a Department of Resources, because what comes out of that is you need to establish the education system, the planning system, to bring forward the resources you need. Now, this is done by government, but I just don't think it's there for people to see and understand.
Mm.
But I can remember back in the, I think it would have been in the 70s, when New South Wales started its major freeway program.
Mm-hmm.
They went to the contractors who didn't have the resources for what they wanted to do, which was the trains for laying the asphaltic concrete to build those roads.
The thing that puts down the concrete.
That walks along the top of the prepared pavement and lays the concrete to all the specified standards. And no one's going to go out and buy one of those trains, whatever the millions of dollars they cost, unless they have the job.
Mm.
And so the government said to, I think it was two of the major contractors, you buy the machines and we'll allocate you the projects. So there had to be the development of the resources to undertake the expenditure.
Mm.
And remember, Albanese was the Minister for Infrastructure back in the Rudd government. And that's why I think Albanese is probably a Prime Minister who's got his head across this kind of thing. And if you could ever pin him down in a room long enough, you could give him my 15-point aid.
That's true.
Get him across MMT.
I think you should just email it to him anyway, Dad. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we're saying the government, there's no limit on the dollars it can create, because dollars are not physical objects. They're just numbers. Numbers, and there's no limit on numbers. And the analogy that's always given is the federal government cannot run out of dollars any more than the umpire can run out of points at the football game. It's just numbers.
Exactly right.
However, we can run out of the resources.
You can run out of resources.
Point eight you've got here is about taxation. So taxation is a necessary part of the monetary system. It's kind of the partner to the spending that the government does. So what did you figure out about taxation?
Well, I guess that was one of the hardest ones. You get to the point where you do understand that, spending comes before taxation. And when taxes are paid, they expire the money that was expended as an entry in a ledger somewhere. So why are we taxing if the government doesn't need to tax to spend? And I thought Stephanie Kelton's book set that out quite well. And there was a comment that I heard Bill Mitchell say, it was to create resource space for government spending.
What do you mean by resource space?
That is to leave the resources available for government to do its planning and expenditure that it needs to do.
Right. So if you're taxing private enterprise and say you've got some mega millionaire who wants to build a casino on the Gold Coast, the government could tax all that money away and say, no, we actually want to build another runway on an airport. Or
that's right. I've sort of looked these numbers up. Australia's around 25%.
Okay.
Government spending. Interestingly, the Scandinavian countries up around 40%.
Mm.
Australia does have a reputation of being a low-tax country. Mm. And I think that gets expressed in the fights we have over childcare and education and medical services. And if you're in a democracy, it ends up where it is. Well, we've got a problem with our democracy, and we've been squeezed down to about 25% of the economy.
Mm.
So that's one reason for taxation. And the other reasons which identified in Stephanie Kelton's book is to control inflation. So you can use taxation instead of the silly idea of raising interest rates, which all it does is feed inflation until you finally send more and more people into distress of unemployment and underemployment, etc. So you can use taxes to control inflation.
That's by controlling spending, is it?
Yes, controlling spending. And if you ask me if I were king, what I'd do, I'd make GST a floating taxation. Instead of having it fixed at 10%, instead of adjusting interest rates and just GST.
Oh, you're just GST. Yeah. What a novel idea. I don't know. I can't tell if you're being progressive or regressive on that one.
But then the other two aspects of why you tax is to address inequality, which I think people more and more are starting to realise these days.
Yeah, too many billionaires.
And people need to appreciate back in the 50s and 60s, taxation rates on income above certain levels in Australia, I think over 60%. In America, it was over 90%.
Mm.
You know, it was really addressing the issue of excessive wealth.
Mm.
And the other reason for taxation, of course, is to modify behaviour.
They're not having so much luck on the tobacco area at the moment with that one.
Well, yeah, there's good policy and bad policy.
So we do need taxation. Even though the federal government can never run out of the dollars, it still needs to tax us. We sort of mentioned inflation. Is there anything else we need to say about inflation?
Oh, yes, because a lot of my career, I was an expert on inflation in contracts.
Okay.
And that came out of the 70s and the inflation spiral of that era.
That means you were writing contracts and you had to factor in what you thought the prices might be in 2 or 3 years' time.
Well, there was all that work, but there was also the shifty work by contractors writing certain fine print into their tenders to wrinkle the inflation formulas and contracts. And in fact, I got to the point where I realised probably in the late 70s that the way in which formulas were constructed in contracts became a profit centre. More than what the real inflationary cost in their contract was. So, yes, I understand and I lived through that whole wages inflation spiral period and the oil crisis and so on, and saw how that affected the economy where I worked. But one simple little point that price increases aren't necessarily inflation.
So true. That was a stunner to me.
Yeah, that was a bit of a surprise. When you think about it, oh, yes, of course, the cost of some things just have to go up for whatever reason. And so instead of being able to spend all the money you were going to spend, you have to divert some of it to this price increase.
Mm.
But some things we just, as a society, should just wear and ride it out and not push up interest rates. Because, you know, in the end, interest rates is about pushing people out of employment, causing stress in the economy for no bloody reason at all.
Fair enough. I think it's one of the things that I hear MMTers are most aggrieved about, aside from the fact that we should have zero involuntary unemployment, is the fact that when the talking heads are talking clinically about adjusting interest rates, what they actually mean is we should put some people into poverty.
Well, more than that, we should kill them.
Austerity is murder. Yep.
Because the austerity is murder, because there will be people. I've worked with people who have been chucked out of work, lived in their car.
Oh, really? Engineers?
Yeah. And I don't know, you know, he just left and anyhow, a while later I hear that he was killed himself somewhere out in New South Wales.
Mm. Yeah. You wonder how many of those kind of deaths would be prevented by people knowing that they had a financial safety net in the form of a job guarantee.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, because even though he wouldn't be employed as an engineer on a job guarantee, he'd be in a holding pattern until the jobs came back. And also, if the government was spending properly on infrastructure, there would be plenty of jobs too.
But I think financial stress and unemployment
it's huge.
Is massive, yep. Particularly in a society where we're all brought up to look forward to a job. I mean, if the government then at least undertakes a job guarantee for everyone under the age of 25 as an extension of the education system.
Mm.
And so that sort of transitions people from over that horror of going from school to a job.
Right.
And turning up to a job, it's engagement.
And it wouldn't be, we have to point out, it wouldn't be like this fake employment programs that are currently we have under either Work for the Dole or Workfare, those kinds of things, which are actually designed to oppress people even more.
No, that's all rubbish.
This would be legitimate work for legitimate wages.
Yeah.
You're listening to 3CR 855 AM on digital and on the internet. www.3cr.org. 3cr.org.au.
What we often end up talking about with modern monetary theory is the government's deficit and the government's debt. And by that, of course, we're talking again about the federal government. And people do get confused around the national debt versus the government debt. So in the national debt, you have to separate out the private sector debt from the government debt. So what we're talking about is the debt of the currency issuer, not other people's debts when we're talking about this. But tell us what you figured out about the debt and deficits.
Well, Anne, I came to realise that deficit is not debt.
That's right.
Well, it's not obvious. People talk about the national debt when they're talking about the deficit, and it's totally confusing. And I was able to sort of realise at some point, oh my goodness, The deficit's got nothing to do with debt.
Hooray! Yes, yes, it's total propaganda to call it debt. Yep.
It's not debt. And the deficit, all it is a calculation between the amount of money the government spends and the amount of taxation it gets back. And if it doesn't get back the amount it's spent, the difference is called a deficit.
It's just an accounting terminology.
Could be called anything. It's just a name for a number on a spreadsheet. And so what's the significance of it? Well, there's no significance at all. It's got nothing to do with anything. The government should spend what it needs to spend to the capacity of the resources of the economy and tax back whatever it needs for inequality, inflation, and modifying behaviour and making space for resources that it needs. But after that, whatever the numbers are, that's what they are. But the worst thing about the whole thing is this process where, for historical reasons, the government issues bonds matching the deficit, and they call that borrowing. And therefore the deficit becomes a debt because the government has borrowed money to pay the debt, which is total bullshit. Can I say that, Anne?
Yes.
Like, just get over it, folks. The government issues bonds as an historical artifact from the gold era.
And they used to need to do this in the gold standard, and I think it's because they needed to kind of freeze the dollars. I always think of bonds as like freezing your dollars so they can't really be spent so easily, so that they weren't messing around with the constraint that the gold standard puts on how many dollars you can have in the economy. But we're not on a gold standard. We don't need to constrain how many dollars there are. And so we don't need the bonds.
No. And what the money people came to realise, we need those bonds for a number of reasons. One is the government pays interest on money that would otherwise not earn any interest, and we're getting a free cash flow for money that we're holding in the central bank account or wherever it is as a major fund manager, paying us interest on our money.
Right.
Whereas what I've come to realise, bonds are probably the most secure asset in the economy. The reason people want to hold bonds is they need, for money management purposes, whoever you are, once you've got enough money, you will hold a certain proportion as bonds because it's always there and it's tradable. Nothing to do with the government borrowing money. It's simply a tradable asset. And we can park it with the government as bonds and they will actually pay us money to leave it there. Whereas what I say is the government should be charging the interest as an insurance premium against that risk-free asset. We've all been conned into the idea that we pay money to people holding wealth is crazy.
Bill Mitchell calls it corporate welfare.
Yeah, that's why. It's free money. You heard during the COVID crisis, all the commentators who were worried about the government giving away money to all these disadvantaged people. All along, year in, month out, week in, week out, there's a flow of money to all those people in the bond issuance system. They are getting free money all the time.
Who are the real bludgers in society?
Exactly right. So Yes, I understand that bonds represent a risk-free asset. That interest rate represents the base interest rate in the economy for doing work in the real economy. Now, I've worked in the real economy, and I know you take the bond rate, and if you're working in a high-risk area like construction, you might have 10% above the bond rate.
Oh, okay. Because otherwise, there's no point doing your construction. You may as well just buy some bonds.
No, you might as well put your money into bonds. Now, the MMT people say that the bond rate should be zero, whereas I say, no, it should be negative because you're giving them a risk-free, secure asset. The government should charge an insurance premium for issuing bonds.
The government's providing a service, which is keeping somebody's money in a safe place.
And the idea of matching the bond issuance to the deficit and calling it debt is puerile logic.
So do you think there is a case to be made to have them to set that lower rate for the rest of the finance sector to calculate like the returns on all those other financial instruments?
Well, if it's zero, then you'd still be working whatever interest rate you need above zero. And so, like these people who keep arguing for the free enterprise system, and I agree 100% about it, but those people should know how to deal with a zero interest bond rate.
And we've seen Japan can pretty much do it.
And they've been doing it for years. The other side of the coin, surplus is the opposite of the deficit.
Which all that means is the government pulled back more in tax than what it spent in that budget year.
And not only that, it means they've extracted money out of the economy. And somewhere in the economy, people are put under stress. And as the MMT people would say, moving into a surplus status in the economy is more than likely to put the economy into a recession. And so it's to be avoided unless there's some other peculiar circumstances occur that by accident create a surplus status. But what I came to sort of appreciate, that a surplus is a bad thing by and large, not a good thing. But Chalmers, our Treasurer Chalmers, rabbits on all the time about the surplus that he's been able to get. And all the political commentators, they're all talking about how important it is to have a surplus. No, it's potentially and probably bad policy. And deficit spending is normal, and the MMT people have done the research and shows that deficit spending has been normal for the last 100 years. And yet it has such capture in the media for propagandising the population.
It really is. MMT is that kind of Alice through the looking glass thing. It does completely flip your understanding. And that's why I think it's sometimes hard for people to grasp in amongst all the propaganda that's out there that deficits are a good thing usually for the private sector and surpluses are a bad thing.
Well, it's demonstrable that the government deficit is equal to the private sector surplus to the dollar. I mean, that was an amazing thing to think about. You think, oh, money's all over the place. How can there be a balance? And you take away the private sector surplus, then you're going to cause problems somewhere in the private sector.
And the reason why Costello could run 8 surpluses was because the private sector went into debt. So that's why you've got people running around with huge mortgages, and I don't think we've really recovered from that. But that's why there's some of that bloat, I think, in the financial sector.
And it doesn't matter what we do or say, we all live in an economy that is a fiat-based currency. And there is no other future other than government running a fiat-based system.
Yes.
There isn't. And that's the only way, when push comes to shove, the government can do anything useful for the greater economy, as demonstrated in COVID when there was a queue outside Centrelink about a mile long when they said, well, everyone's out of a job, you've got to go home. On Monday, by the following Monday, the government announced a $200 billion wage subsidy package.
Where did that $200 billion come from?
Well, that's what I say to people. It wasn't in a safe. in Canberra.
They had to go and look down the back of the couch in Canberra.
They just decided that we have to do something about this. I reckon the mistake that they made, but it was a Liberal government, and why wouldn't they make this mistake, is that they didn't tax it back at the top. Because all that expenditure was going to flow into the economy through the hands of people who needed it. It ends up in the hands of, by and large, the wealthy. And as Harvey Norman said, I'm not giving any of it back.
Yeah. The billionaires increased in both the number of billionaires in Australia and the amount of wealth. I know Gina Rinehart's wealth effectively doubled after COVID, because that $200 billion, it had to go somewhere.
Well, I've seen a chart that shows that around the world, the billionaires on average wealth increased 60% over the COVID period.
And that shows you so clearly why the government needs to tax as well as to spend, but it needs to tax in the right places.
That's right. And now as it's settled down, we just have billionaires who are sitting on multiple billions, and they're around pulling political strings wherever they like.
You're listening to 3CR 855 AM on digital and on the internet. www.3cr.org.au.
Well, we've gone through all 15 points, not quite in order, but that's fine. You can never do them in order, I find, because everything connects to everything else.
Well, that's so true.
But I hope that's given some newbies out there just a bit of an overview of the main points that MMT is telling us. And I guess my final question for you would be, why don't they get it? Like, I know it took both of us a few years to get our heads around this, but if someone just handed us this bit of paper that you've created, this A4 sheet, none of this is intellectually difficult, right?
No.
So why don't they get it? Why don't they get the simplicity of it?
I think it probably comes down to vested interests. Take bond trading. What if we said we don't need bonds? Warren Mosler has identified the overheads in the economy that could be got rid of if we just remove the unnecessary financialisation that exists in the economy.
Mm.
You know, Bill Mitchell, there's a whole academic work on groupthink, which I hadn't come across before. And that's a problem with the economic work in universities. You can't get on and get promoted unless you become part of the club.
Mm.
And you learn what to parrot like everybody else. And there's lots of busy little corners you can go and work in and look like you're productive that mean that people are protecting their jobs.
Yes.
Yeah. There's lots of reasons like apathy and poor education. The ideology of neoliberalism doesn't want us to know about it. And it dominates the media. You put me onto the Powell Memorandum.
Mm.
When I read that, I'd have to say I was deeply shocked, because I realised all the dots I'd seen along my life and career. I thought, oh my goodness, this has all been pre-planned out. And Powell touched on the need to take over the higher levels of education. And Trump's accelerated that. The Powell Memorandum is stage one of what is now the 2025 Heritage Foundation undertaking.
And Australia, we've got to inoculate ourselves.
Well, we've done a little bit of that with the last election. I am curious to see how Chalmers deals with whether he still rabbits on about the need for a surplus and the deficit is debt. You know, will they have the courage to move away from that propaganda?
And it certainly will help if a wider part of the population gets an understanding of how the economy really works. Then we'll be shifting that Overton window, which is a hard one to budge, but we're doing our little bit here today.
Yeah, I hope so, man.
Is there any other parting words of advice you'd like to give to anyone starting out trying to get their heads around this stuff?
Oh, I just go first to understanding what a fair currency means and deficits, not debt.
Mm.
And I really think the history of some of this economic stuff is fascinating. I wish I had another life to go and do that. But the Hutt Wars in Africa and just Google the Hut Wars, the tally sticks in England. Like, there's some incredible irony. Tally sticks were used as a tax mechanism.
Mm.
And tally sticks was a piece of wood split in two. One was kept by the king and the other was handed out to pay your taxes in the future. And to earn those taxes, you had to do stuff for the king. And then the tally sticks was handed back to the king or parliament. These tally sticks were operated for about 200 or 300 years and they were all stored in the Houses of Parliament in England.
Yeah.
And you know what the government decided one day? To have them burnt. You know what the blokes down in the dungeon of the Parliament Houses did? They burnt them. And you know what they did? They burnt down the Houses of Parliament at the same time.
You just see the minister sitting there going, can you smell smoke?
I could not believe it when I read that bit of history, that the tally sticks were responsible for burning down the houses of English Houses of Parliament.
It's a beautiful moment, isn't it?
So there was a tally stick story,
mm-hmm.
and the colonials, it wasn't the Americans then, it was the British colonials in America, created the first paper money in Western society, and it was a tax credit. And a few years later, the first bonds were issued, 1696, I think, were issued by the Bank of England, first bonds.
Okay.
They're still issuing the damn things, which is a mistake. But anyway.
Unfortunately.
And the French and the Dutch followed soon after when everybody started, we can operate an economy by using paper. And what I was amazed about was the first paper money was 100 pound notes.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
How does that work to buy your loaf of bread?
Well, exactly. You know, obviously, if it was for handing money, I'd say, between all the elements of the aristocracy around England.
Mm.
And then they started to realise, oh, we need 50 pound notes.
Mm.
And after a few years, I think it took about 20 or 30 years before they got down to 1 pound notes.
Yeah, that just goes to show at one point, the economy was partly on a monetary system and partly not.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, well, look, who needs the revolution when the government is willing to burn down its own parliament?
Yeah, well, maybe it'll happen again.
All right, well, thank you very much, Ray, for spending some time here on Radio MMT.
All right, thanks, Anne.
You've been listening to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev.
We'd love your feedback. Email us on radiommt@gmail.com or search Radio MMT on social media.
Listen to this show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts or on 3cr.org.au/Radio MMT.
Support this show and the station by subscribing to 3cr.org.au and mention Radio MMT.
We thank all our guests.
And we thank economist Professor Bill Mitchell and his MMTED.org, educating the masses on modern monetary theory.
And thank you to our listening listeners for listening. And I thank you, Kevin.
And I thank you, Anne. So what's planned for next week?
Kevin, there is still so much to talk about. We've got to expose all this rotten economics.
Well, that's good, and I get it. Do you reckon we could use a bit more music?
Well, I made a list of all these terrible economic theories. Like, have you heard of the theory of comparative advantage or the quantity theory of money or the loanable funds theory?
Have you heard of a band called Single Gun Theory? Like, they're a really good band. I'm sure there's a whole range of, like, macroeconomic music that I could bring into the show.
Yeah, but we really need to do marginal productivity theory, not to mention the natural rate of unemployment and the money multiplier.
You've got a pretty good singing voice. I play bass. Bill, he plays guitar. I reckon we could form a macroeconomic band. Like, we could deliver this whole message by music.
Well, we could call the band the Permanent Income Hypothesis, or the Ricardian Equivalence, or Rational Expectations.
I think we're onto something here. We're trying to make macroeconomics more interesting to the masses. We're going to, like, form this band and sing it to them. And we're going to bring the economists in. We're going to get musical.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.